for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For the second time in a week, women are being advised on new guidelines for cancer screening. Senate Democrats scrambled to secure votes for a sweeping health care bill. Congress and the Pentagon open investigations into the Fort Hood massacre, and a computer glitch snarls air traffic across the country. Joining me in the studio for this week's domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eleanor Clift, tell us about this health care bill that the Senate Democrats have unveiled. How different from or similar to the House bill is it?
Well, it has the core ingredients of the House bill in that it lifts many insurance restrictions, and it includes a sort of a fig leaf of a public option, which would allow states to opt out, although opting out is a fairly high hurdle. They have to get legislative approval and so forth. And the Senate bill delays the implementation of any kind of public option. In fact, many of the portions of the bill until 2014, which is a year further out than the House, in part, I think, to save money and have the overall number come in. I think it's at $848 billion is what the last number is.
And it would extend the insurance to 31
million people. And I think it gets it up in the 90th percentile of covered people.
Byron, what about the issue of abortion coverage in the Senate bill?
It's different from the Stupak amendment that passed in the House. And the basic issue is whether money is fungible or not, in the sense that the Stupak amendment suggested that anyone who receives any subsidy for a policy and then has a policy that covers abortion, then the federal money couldn't be used in any sense for that. The Reid plan is an idea that you can somehow segregate the monies involved, and that a person could receive a subsidy for an insurance policy and separately have a policy that covered abortion.
So, Naftali, what about the GOP reaction to this whole plan? One Senator, Tom Coburn, wants the whole 2,074 pages read on the Senate floor.
Yeah, the Republican response is pretty much uniformly negative, I think it's fair to say. They are going to use whatever parliamentary tactics they can to delay this. They're going to filibuster. There are probably half a dozen points during debate when this thing could be filibustered. And as you say, there's a proposal by Tom Coburn, although I think he's backed off it, to have the thing read word for word, which you can do.
Which would have taken 34 hours.
At least. It would have taken a long time. And sometimes what Democrats do in these situations, they actually bring in speed readers to read the thing as fast as possible. And it gets to be kind of a circus. And I think we're likely to see that circus unfold in the next few weeks. But I think an important item here is that it's not just Republicans. You know, there's a lot of Democrats that have issues with part of this bill. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi could lose 40 Democrats and still have the thing pass. Harry Reid can't lose one Democrat, and he can't lose any independents. So I think his legislative challenge is going to be quite difficult.
And there are parts of this bill that are completely new. This whole states can opt out of the public option. Several committees had hearings. Several committees came up with bills. None of those bills had that. But now, after several days in Harry Reid's office, out has popped this plan for a public option, which, by the way, I think the CBO says is not actually going to result in lowering costs or lowering premiums, may indeed have higher premiums than private companies.
Well, the opt-out provision was discussed extensively before. That's hardly a surprise. And I think people who support the public option are frustrated that the way it's being designed, it will probably cost more than private plans. It will get the sickest people. It won't have the tools to negotiate lower rates. And so it's designed not to be competitive with the insurance industry, basically. So this is essentially, I think, a pretty big win for the insurance companies. But it's also a foot in the door on the public option, and it is apparently the best that can be gotten out of the Senate as it's currently constituted.
So what happens next?
Well, there's a vote tomorrow on what's called the motion to proceed, which simply means opening debate. And it's not 100% sure that Harry Reid has the 60 votes he needs to get that motion to begin debate. My gut feeling is that he probably does. There's been more positive comments from some of the moderate Democrats that might be expected to oppose this thing. But once that happens, all that means is we have several weeks of amendments and horse trading and jockeying and back and forth. You know, the House debate took a day. The Senate debate is likely to take at least 3 weeks. So I think that's going to be quite a lively and often contentious debate that we're going to see unfolding as the Democrats feel a lot of pressure to get this done by the end of the year.
But, you know, that's how the Senate works. And I don't think we should be afraid of that. I mean, there will be contentious debate. It will take a while. There will be lots of amendments. And this is the first time that the Congress is on the verge of passing major legislation in some time. They're a little bit out of practice.
How are they going to pay for this, Byron?
Well, they're going to have to figure out some way to bridge the differences between the House and the Senate. Both House and Senate would pay for a lot of it by cutting Medicare up to $500 billion in Medicare payments over the next decade. The House would have this so-called millionaire's tax, pay for a lot of it for that way. The Senate still has the tax on the so-called Cadillac health insurance plans, and they also have something now. I believe they increased the withholding from Medicare tax for people above a certain income.
And half a percentile.
Half a percent, and then they have something called the Botox, which is a tax on elective cosmetic surgery.
So is the president going to have a bill to sign by the end of the year, Naftali?
I think he's going to have a bill to sign by the State of the Union address. I think it's very, very important for him to be able to get up and say, you know, we told you we were going to bring change. We brought change. We've done something no one's been able to do for a century. Now, what that bill will be is an open question. And there are a lot of advocates of reform who are afraid that it will be hollowed out, that he'll have to back off on the public option, that he'll have to back off on abortion language. So my guess is there's too much riding on this for Democratic leaders not to pass something. But again, the question is really what it contains and whether it fulfills the vision of people who are really pushing this to begin with.
Byron?
I think the reason we're seeing this big push is that support for healthcare for this particular style of healthcare reform is not growing. A lot of polls show a plurality of people actually opposed to the plans on the table right now. With each day that passes, we get closer to the 2010 midterm elections. And I think Democratic leaders, and you see this by Harry Reid wanting to meet on Saturday, and I believe the House bill was passed on a Saturday. They don't want their members to go home. I think they're rushing to get it done before support diminishes further.
So do you believe the president will have something to sign by either the State of the Union or the end of
the
year?
Well, I would agree with Naftali on the State of the Union. And I know that he'll have supporters in the Democratic Party are saying you've got 258 Democrats in the House and 60 in the Senate, and you can't get this done. I think there's enormous pressure to pass something.
And after the 2010 elections, there will be fewer Democrats probably in both chambers. So I think there is a feeling among Democrats now or never. And while it's a plurality of support for health care reform, if they don't pass anything, there's not going to be a sigh of relief around the country. The Democrats will be punished.
I actually think there's even another reason why there's so much pressure for urgency, and that is there's a tremendous amount of concern in the country and in the Congress about jobs and about the economy, and the Democrats really feel like they need to be showing they're doing something to take care of that. And to the extent that they're seen to be focusing on health reform, which rightly or wrongly is seen as sort of a side issue to the central issue of jobs and the economy, I think they're afraid that that's damaging. They want to get that out of the way and turn their focus as quickly as possible to jobs.
That's exactly right. The polls are showing, and the Obama White House is increasingly concerned, that the president appears to not have his priorities entirely straight. It's not that health care is not important to people. It's just that jobs are much, much more important.
If these new tax laws go into effect and if health care does pass, how might the economy grow, Eleanor?
Well, I think the prospect of a more realistic healthcare system does unlock the job market. I think you do have corporations who feel burdened by the cost of healthcare, and you have small businesses who either can't afford to pay or are, you know, aren't paying at all and aren't covering people, or are paying more than they can afford. But, you know, I don't see this as a great job creator. And I think that's why the White House is having a summit in December trying to bring together ideas. And I think there will be a jobs package before the Congress, presumably early next year, because people understand that the fact that we're not creating jobs, you know, we've always lost jobs, but we're not creating new ones, and we're losing the manufacturing sector in this country has been decimated. So there's room for a lot of creative thinking here.
But when the president came into office, he said that the first priority had to be health care before you could get the economy back on track.
Well, actually, when he came into office, the stimulus was the big thing that they worked on to begin with, and they suggested that if the stimulus were passed, unemployment would remain at 8% or below, and if it were not passed, it might go above 9%. That didn't happen. Then he later changed the idea to say you can't have true recovery without health care reform.
Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, talk about mammogram screening guidelines. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal. Before we turn to mammogram screening guidelines, here's an email from Dave in Silver Spring. He says, the front page of the Washington Post states that Congress is blaming Obama for the slow return of our economy. What blasphemy! Does Congress not hold the keys to the money in our government? What have Congressmen Brady and Burgess proposed that would have our economy off and running and full employment? This is just more the blame game that the public has grown tired of. We're looking for folks to do something, stand for something, and be counted. Byron.
Well, in Washington, presidents who inherit big messes eventually come to own those messes. And certainly Obama inherited a huge mess, and he's in the process right now of coming to own it. He doesn't fully own the economy, but that a lot of things that we're talking about, for example, the stimulus and health care, are things that he is doing. So Ronald Reagan, when he was elected in 1980, came into office in 81, had a 65% approval rating in March or April of that year. A year later, he had a 45-46 positive-negative approval rating because, in part, unemployment had become high, and he owned the economy by that time. And I think after a while, Obama will own this one.
Eleanor?
Well, Democrats are nervous because they're looking at the numbers and they're worried about their reelection prospects. So what else is new there? And Republicans see political opportunity. And I think the way this panel yesterday went after the Treasury Secretary, I think that basically they're setting him up to be the scapegoat for the policies.
Yes,
but
I do want to talk about that.
Yeah, in fairness, the policies that the Obama administration has put in place to expect them to have come fully into their own in 8 or 9 months is unrealistic. And so I think people will have a better idea of whether the approach this administration has taken is working by the middle of next year. And if it isn't, the Democrats will pay a price in the
elections. Naftali, Congressman Michael Burgess, Republican of Texas, said to Geithner, "I don't think you should be fired," he said. "I thought you should never have been hired." What is the criticism focused on regarding Treasury Secretary Geithner?
Well, there's sort of an array of criticisms. Some of them have to do with the fact that he didn't put forth, as these critics see it, a sort of clear, comprehensive approach to improving the economy. They have to do with the bailout that was given to AIG and the aftermath of that and whether or not there was sufficient monitoring to make sure that that worked. But I think to some degree you're seeing something that happens in administrations where people focus on, they don't want to necessarily focus on the president, but they focus on a cabinet member as sort of a place to aim their ire. And the thing, again, that struck me about it is that it wasn't just Republicans who you might expect to do some of this, but there are some Democrats that are starting to be critical. It's not widespread yet, but you saw one Democratic Congressman, Pete DeFazio, call for his resignation. You're seeing sort of more veiled criticism from other quarters. There's really growing concern and frustration about the economy, and he's a very natural place for some of that to land.
And this dissatisfaction, it really is across the ideological spectrum, because there is this anger. The AIG case is kind of the moral hazard writ large, that the American taxpayer bailed this company out just in extraordinary amounts of money, bailed other Wall Street people out, seeing the enormous profit reports that we've seen from some institutions and the huge bonuses. This is something that really people on the left are very unhappy about. If you go to the Tea Parties, they're very unhappy about it, and they do blame Republicans as well as Democrats in this. This is something that is not going away.
Even. I must say I'm with the listener who said it would be refreshing to hear what full employment program people are offering. I don't know what the Republican jobs program is other than more tax cuts. And I'd like to hear some alternatives. And it's easy to just to criticize.
One caller says, with the economy in decline, with health care possibly going into effect and new tax laws, can we expect the banks to have worse problems than they're having now? We're losing more jobs than we're gaining.
Well, I mean, it's true that one thing that strikes a lot of people is that the banks seem to be doing pretty well while everyone else seems to be doing pretty badly. That's at least the perception, and I think that's fueling something of a populist response on both the left and the right to all this. I think there's a little bit of a reality here that's perhaps not acknowledged often enough, which is that there's only so much Congress and the president can really do to turn around the economy. If it were that clear and that easy, everyone would do it. There are certain things they can do for sure. But ultimately, the economy has to right itself to some degree. But people want their leaders to be doing something to help them and fix it. And I think that's where some of the frustration comes from.
Well, that's what the president said when he called for this summit, which I believe is in early December. He said we want to know what government can do and should do. It's not government cannot come in and just save all these jobs, and they can be a catalyst. But you can bet the same people that are screaming that the administration is not doing something will scream about government involvement if they do get more aggressive.
Well, speaking about government involvement, sort of one step removed, talk about these new guidelines for mammograms, Elner. Some Republicans are calling them health care rationing. And then today we had even more new guidelines on pap screening.
Well, the critics are calling it healthcare rationing as though this is somehow part of the Obama healthcare, but in fact it's happening in the current market. And the next question is, how will the insurance companies interpret these guidelines?
Of course.
I think that's where the fear is.
Yeah.
That women who think they should get a mammogram every year between 40 and 50, or every year 50 and over, are afraid it's not going to be paid. Now, I do understand there is a certain rationale behind the guidelines that they put out. But I think every woman knows, as I do, I mean, I have three friends who were diagnosed with breast cancer in their 40s, and two of them died. And they were diagnosed with mammograms. And I don't believe they had histories of breast cancer. So I think it can be an individual decision. But to say that the risk outweighs the benefit, and they refer to the anxiety of false positives, I mean, I think most of us can handle a little anxiety. And I don't believe that the accumulation of the radiological tests is significant. So I don't think that they made the case well enough. And they're up against really a business of cancer care.
You know, it was interesting. Yesterday we did a program on this very issue. And within a couple of hours, Kathleen Sebelius, the HHS secretary, seemed to back away from these guidelines, saying you should do whatever you want to do. But the key question is this an opportunity for insurance companies to say, we're not going to cover it?
Well, I think it may be an opportunity for that. I mean, I think, unfortunately, this has all been swallowed up in the political fight over health reform.
Healthcare.
Because what perhaps should be a scientific medical discussion, albeit one that's confusing. People have been told that they got to get screened all the time, and all of a sudden that's being reversed.
And who told them?
The same panel is among the people who told them. And even now you have other groups saying, you know, standing by those recommendations, even while this one. But I think this was, by all appearances, an honest medical scientific judgment that this group reached, whatever you think of it. Looking at statistics and history. These are epidemiologists who, this is sort of what they do. Admittedly, they're not oncologists, but what they do is they look at how diseases are spread and can be prevented. But it got pulled into the whole health reform debate, where people were very quick to say, aha, rationing has begun. This is what you're going to get under the Obama system, a bureaucrat between you and your doctor. And I think that's unfortunate.
What I didn't understand was why there was not one oncologist on that panel. There were two pediatricians on that panel, but not one breast cancer or cancer specialist.
It didn't make a lot of sense. By the way, this was a panel called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which many of us hadn't really heard of before. This would have been big news at any time, because there is a Now They Tell Us feature to this kind of story. But it would be impossible for it not to be caught up in the healthcare debate, because all of the bills currently contemplated on Capitol Hill create a system in which a government agency would define what they call acceptable health care coverage. And you as a citizen would have to show them that you have, verify that you have acceptable health care coverage. They define what that is. And then if there is a public option, of course, then the government would decide what coverage is offered there. This is a government agency. The Preventive Services Task Force is created by the Department of Health and Human Services.
But then she
Exactly. This is not just an issue of private insurance companies.
Yeah.
In the new regime, if it were to pass, the government would be making judgments about this, and people are notably, understandably nervous about it.
Well, she backed away from it, and saying that the decision ultimately does rest with the HHS. I think it's an attempt to reassure people that if a panel comes up with something that seems a little off the wall, that they don't have to accept it. And I think it is in such flux that she probably did the right thing. Although I noticed Steve Perlstein in the Post today takes her to task, saying that, if you want to get health care costs under control and have a rational system, you know, this is the kind of thing you have to do. But if you're the one woman out of the 1900 in her 40s whose breast cancer is not detected, well, you've got another version.
But the government will decide under these reform plans what is covered under an acceptable plan.
And it will have to be. The insurance companies decide today what
exactly.
they will cover. So
exactly.
pick your poison.
Let's talk about the White House discovery of tens of millions of dollars in improper Medicare payments. What happened there? Naftali.
Well, there was this finding that instances of Medicare fraud had jumped by 38% over the past year. I think this needs to be looked at with some caution because, by all accounts, the vast majority of that had to do with a different way of accounting for these things and of stricter reporting requirements.
And not fraud.
Right. I mean, right.
Some of it
is incomplete,
right.
Documentation. Some of it is illegible signatures by doctors. I think this has to be taken with a certain amount of caution. But again, we're in the middle of a big debate over health reform. And one of the issues this inevitably raises is the capacity of the government to run large-scale health programs. So I think we still have to wait and see how this all plays out and see what happens over the next couple of years. But again, this is going to be pulled right into that debate.
It is an extraordinary amount of money, I think, across administrations, there's been estimates of, 4 to 5% each year of waste in a program that's $500 billion a year almost, I think. It's a huge amount of money.
Well, I'm not necessarily defending waste, fraud, and abuse. I'm glad to know it's there so they can go after it and maybe
Let's
pick up some
do.
Money. And second of all, in corporate life, there's some waste, fraud, and abuse as well, and we've seen that certainly documented in recent years.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Attorney General Holder has decided he's going to prosecute the 9/11 attackers by a terrorism trial in New York City. What's your reaction?
Well, he went before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday and got a lot of questions about it and had a little difficulty explaining precisely why he chose to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the alleged mastermind of 9/11, in New York City, and why he tried to chose a military commission to try a terrorist accused of blowing up the USS Cole, the warship. Republicans are absolutely dead set against it. I think they're right in this sense because I think we have a perfect, not perfect, but we have a constitutionally approved system of military commissions. It would have been quite reasonable for trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But Holder says that this is what he's going to do. And by the way, he says he made the decision on his own and did not consult beforehand with the president about
What's the rationale for New York City, Eleanor?
Well, typically, if you can assemble a fair jury, fair-minded jury, you do try crimes in the venue where they have been perpetrated. And I think that the Attorney General made a good case that the government has a strong case to bring against this man. A death penalty is likely. And this is an opportunity for the administration and for America to score propaganda points across the world, that we are not afraid to offer the same rights and protections of a jury trial to somebody who's committed this horrific crime, and that justice will be done. And I think the fact that the Justice Department operated separate from the White House is the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to have sort of a separation of powers here, with the White House not directing as Attorney General on what to do.
Enough
politically, he's taking a lot of criticism, but
yeah.
I suspect that once the justice is rendered, that people will look at this in a different light.
Naftali, the Attorney General said he's going to seek the death penalty in the September 11 case. What happens if one or all are acquitted?
Well, that's, of course, a question that comes up and one of the things that's raised by people who disagree with this decision. The truth is that I think it's almost inconceivable that they would just be let loose. What will happen is that then the Justice Department will come back in and charge them with something else. There's no way they're going to let these guys free. It would be, among other things, a political disaster, let alone a substantive one. So I don't think we probably really have to worry about that happening. But there's an interesting thing that happened this week, too, where President Obama virtually predicted that these people would be put to death. He was responding to a question.
It was almost a guarantee, I think.
Right, right. Somebody said, you know, it was a television interviewer, and they said, you know, how do you respond to people who think it's offensive that these mass murderers are being tried like ordinary defendants? And he said, well, I don't think they'll find it's offensive when these people are convicted and put to death. He then backed off because really a president shouldn't be prejudging a criminal case. But it shows you the political complexity of the waters that he's navigating here.
Can you find an impartial jury in New York City,
Byron? Well, I would think that one of the things that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's legal team would do would be to try to get a change of venue. And it seems like he has a credible argument for that because it would be almost hard to find an impartial jury in the United States, but certainly in Manhattan.
I've read a little bit about this. Impartial is not quite the word. Fair-minded is the word. And you can't get have people going in with an absolute blank slate. And apparently we've had many high-profile trials. And in fact, the bombers of the World Trade Center from 1993 were prosecuted successfully in New York.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal. When we come back, it's time for your phone calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. President Obama returns home from his first official visit to Asia. Secretary of State Clinton attends the inauguration of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. A panel of journalists on these stories and the rest of the week's top international news. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. Let's go first to Guilford, Connecticut, and Paul. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I sort of have one housekeeping question. I called in several weeks ago, and I was cut off to get an answer to my question. I'm wondering if there's any way I can get an answer.
Well,
get a recording of some sort.
Well, I don't know about that, sir. You, I have to go back to the show you're talking about. Give me your question for this morning.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I'm wondering about doctors and hospitals' fees and charges. Why not? excuse me, I wrote it down here. Why not establish standard fees and charges for established treatments and procedures in hospitals? I have a friend up in Boston who needed an angioplasty. And at one hospital, I'm not going to mention the names of the hospitals, the charge was $56,000. Now, that's an established procedure. Across the river, another hospital, same people, same staff, $36,000. And there's such a discrepancy in fees. Is this addressed in the bill?
Well, it's not addressed per se in the bill. I mean, you know, Medicare does provide certain payments for certain procedures, and there's an attempt to sort of use the government in that way to affect the private market. Although there's some complaint that Medicare underpays, and therefore it requires, for private procedures then to overcharge. But I think something like that would meet with great political resistance. There's already some protest of the idea of the government having a bigger influence on the healthcare system, and I think if the government actually tried to mandate prices, I mean, you hear the response we already get to things like comparative effectiveness research. I have a feeling that that's the kind of thing that there would be a tremendous backlash against if it were attempted.
Well, there are some efforts to begin the movement away from fee-for-service so that the system doesn't depend on everybody getting paid for what procedure they perform, and physicians get paid for caring for a patient with an illness. I think there are some baby steps to begin that, but to take on the whole fee-for-service methodology that we have would be a huge political fight. So I think that they've made some attempt to get at that.
Well, one of the big fights about the public option proposals were, is this a public option that's just going to offer coverage to people who don't have it, or is it going to be something that's going to actually cut costs? And the cost-cutting party and all this, the faction and all this, wanted the public option to impose Medicare rates on doctors and hospitals. That didn't fly, which is why we're seeing estimates that a public option may actually be more expensive than private coverage. But there was a group that wanted those very kind of controls in a public option.
More expensive than private coverage, but covering people who could not get coverage from private insurance because companies, because they're regarded as too sick and
at
risk.
Go. Now to Lakewood, Washington. Good morning. Good morning, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling from Lakewood, Washington. My husband's in the Army, and your speaker was talking about people wanting the government to do something. And, yeah, I guess when you're talking about creating jobs or you're talking about something to stimulate the economy, yeah, let's have them do something. But when they want to fundamentally change American life by the whole ideology, the socialist spreading the wealth, which is now going global from some of the things that he said in his speeches lately. I'm not an economist, but I'm an American, and I don't want my government taking over my life. And they're doing it on many different levels, and people need to wake up, and we need to be heard.
Eleanor.
Well, I think creating insurance exchanges where people can shop among different health care plans is not a government takeover. It's enabling people to have access to affordable health care. So a lot of terminology thrown around and a lot of mythology about what
I was about to say, how has this sense of the government taking over your life being created, Naftali?
Well, I think it's there's a lot of answers to that. I think they've passed a certain number of big ticket items like the stimulus, and they're looking to pass a fairly comprehensive health care plan. But I think one thing that we've seen is the rise of this movement, of this Tea Party movement, of people that are very vehement and have this feeling that I'm not qualified to explain, you know, exactly where it comes from in detail, but this sort of ardent emotional response to what's happening. And it's playing out in a very politically real way. It's playing out mostly within the Republican Party, although a lot of these people are critical of the Republican Party as well as they are of the Democratic Party. And you're seeing some real divisions that I think could have some ramifications in the next election.
It's an angry populism on the right, and their hero is Sarah Palin.
Exactly.
But there are actual elements of coercion in these healthcare proposals. I mean, you will have to have insurance coverage that is acceptable as defined by the government. If you don't have it, you will be fined. The IRS will be the enforcement agency for this fines. And this is it's not surprising that you would find a number of people who are unhappy about this. As far as I've been to a number of these so-called Tea Party rallies, and there is a concern that the government is moving on a number of fronts kind of to push the country off the cliff. And the speed with which the government is moving is something that disturbs them. They're disturbed about the deficit.
I'm troubled.
Well, I'll tell you, they're disturbed about
it. Wait a minute.
Frame it.
I'm troubled by your saying moving the country off the cliff.
They're troubled by the deficit, which is a tripling of an already high deficit, and really no sense that it will go down anytime in the future. They're worried about its effects on the economy and on the currency. They're certainly worried about health care. They do not like the cap and trade proposal, which passed the House. And what I'm telling you is that they're concerned about this wide range. You would not have had a rally in Washington that was as big as it was if it were just about health care or just about the deficit or just about cash for clunkers or any particular thing. It was this sense that the president and the Democratic majorities are moving so fast on so many fronts.
But where were the Republicans when President Bush was taking this deficit up? And up and up.
Well, certainly.
And before you answer that, let me just say on health care, I, as a citizen, know that I am paying for those who are not insured, who go to emergency rooms, ask for service, the hospital gives it to them, and I, as a taxpayer, pay for it because they have no opportunity to get insurance. This is in part one of the criticisms that is made when you're talking about trying to insure
everyone. Why should
everyone?
We pay for all the free riders?
Exactly.
And why do people have car insurance so that when you get in an accident, exactly. And when you phrase it that the government is mandating what has to be in a healthcare plan, I would look at it that the government is saying the minimum that has to be included. It's a consumer protection because you have so many people who are undercovered. And Bruce Bartlett, who was one of the supply-side economists during the Reagan era, has a book out. He explained that the deficit that Bush left was $1.2 trillion. It was now $1.4 trillion. He said half of that was to do with the economic slowdown, and the other half of that modest increase has to do with the Obama policies, and that it has been taken way out of control, basically blaming this all on the Obama administration.
Let me understand the impact of Sarah Palin, her tour, her book, her appearance on Oprah. What's she after? Naftali.
I actually think that's the big question. I mean, there's no question that her appearances have ignited all kinds of a response on both sides. She's getting big crowds. Her detractors and her supporters are coming out in force. But I think the big question is, what does she want? There's obviously some possibility that she would run for president in 2012. If she did, I think it would be it would cause quite a reaction within the Republican Party because she has very ardent supporters, but I'm not sure she could actually win the nomination. But it's also quite possible that what she wants to do is sort of be a leader of a movement, to appear, to speak, to criticize, to make money. And she knows that keeping open the possibility of a presidential run is the best way to keep attention. So I don't think it's quite clear yet what her actual goals are.
All right. To Newport, New Hampshire. Good morning, Lewis.
Good morning. I wanted to comment on this idea of whether there can be found an impartial or what was the other word that was used there?
Fair-minded. Open-minded. Good enough.
For the KSM trial. I think that the issue there is that people seem to misunderstand these catchphrases. Impartial jury doesn't mean people who are a complete blank slate. Everybody can agree a crime was committed. Everybody can agree it was a horrible atrocity. Everybody can agree this should there should be some justice. The question is, can you find somebody? And I think that it's extremely easy to find somebody who has no vested interest in convicting KSM specifically. I don't know anything about this guy, except I've seen a picture of him when he looked kind of bedraggled, wearing a white beater T-shirt, looked like he had just been waterboarded. That's all I know. So he had some stubble on his face. That's it. I don't know that whether he was a banker, whether he was a criminal, what?
Well, there are a number of serious issues about this case that go beyond the jury, although I do worry about some lone holdout juror. I mean, you never can tell. But we waterboarded this guy a bunch of times. There are a lot of issues about his interrogation. Certainly his lawyers will argue that any information we have, whether it was before or after the waterboarding, wherever it came from, is tainted by the nature of this case. It is extremely difficult to try in a civilian
court.
Well,
the attorney general answered that and basically suggested that they have evidence that has not come to light and that he was comfortable if there was evidence that was secured before.
There will be another side
of
the case, and we'll have lawyers that will make a case.
Let's talk about the other investigation into Fort Hood and what's going on there, Naftali.
Well, it's actually a series of different investigations, which is, I think, part of the reason you were seeing some conflict. The military has an investigation, but yesterday Senator Joe Lieberman started the first public hearings, I guess, about this whole thing. He's chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. But I think what we're seeing is a little bit of friction between the Congress and the administration, even though both are controlled by the Democratic Party, because, as might be expected, Congress wants to have a lot of high-profile public hearings to look into this, and the administration is worried about its ongoing investigations. And as always, there's a little bit of a political subtext to this. I think the administration is worried about embarrassment, about sort of the claims that they failed to connect the dots and see this whole thing coming. And of course, Congress always loves to be in the spotlight and to some degree to embarrass the administration. So I think this very quickly moved from the phase of everybody bemoaning what was a horrible tragedy and into the phase of jockeying for position.
Well, Senator Lieberman is not controlled by the Democratic Party. That's for sure. And he's the one who's running this investigation.
So now you've got former Army Secretary Togo West, former Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Vernon Clark, going to head a 45-day review. The signs that this guy had problems were just so apparent.
They were big flashing lights. Oh. And it has become a political issue because it seems that there were issues of political correctness that some of his colleagues were worried about calling him out. For even though they got the idea that he was contemplating Islamic jihadi violence.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just had a quick comment. I'm a preventive medicine physician and actually have worked with the United States Preventive Services Task Force, and I wanted to make a couple of comments. Because a lot of the information regarding new mammogram screenings are actually being misconstrued. There are 16 members on the task force, 8 of which are women. They did convene a separate panel to look at a lot of the oncology information, 4 of which were oncologists, 1 was a cancer surgeon, and 1 was a cancer researcher. Cost, actual monetary cost, had nothing to do with their recommendations. And today's medical system, basically evidence-based medicine, you have to prove that what you're doing is actually not harming more people than it's doing them good. And we have known that for the last 20 years, all the studies have said the same thing, that the mortality benefit from screening women aged 40 to 49 is minimal at best.
And that's what ethicist Arthur Kaplan said on this program yesterday, that unless we begin to move to that evidence-based medicine, we are going to continue to see these costs skyrocket.
Well, it's also premised on the notion that everybody has a doctor that they can have this conversation
Absolutely.
With. When we have 50 million people without access to health insurance, and the fear is that those are the people who are going to pay the price.
Forgive me, our breast cancer show was on Wednesday and not yesterday. Finally, to Crofton, Maryland. Good morning, Eileen. Very quickly, please.
Hey, good morning. Thanks, Sal, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment about the national health care issue, and that is most Americans are so ignorant as to what socialism really is. It's not necessarily a bogeyman. Our allies and friends all have national health care programs, and they are doing very nicely. My other comment is regarding an earlier caller who I believe made the comment that her husband is in the Army. I don't know if she realizes it or not. I'm saying this as an Army veteran myself. Her husband, because he has dependents, makes more money than his single compatriots. And, you know, strictly speaking, that's socialism.
All right. Thanks for your call. President Obama acknowledged he won't be able to close Guantanamo on time, Eleanor. How serious is that for the administration?
Oh, I think it's been apparent for quite some time that he wouldn't be able to meet the deadline. There are still upwards of 100 people there that they haven't figured out what to do. I mean, if you're keeping a checklist, you can say promise not kept, but it's a promise that will eventually be kept.
And finally, Senator Robert Byrd made a rare appearance on the floor of the U.S. Senate on Wednesday to mark his 20,774th day as a member of Congress. What's his legacy, Naftali?
Well, he's served almost 57 years, longer than any other member of Congress. He's held many leadership positions and brought a lot of money to West Virginia. He's an acknowledged expert on the Constitution and on the U.S. Senate. But I think the big thing that the important thing is, will he be able to show up for votes in the next few weeks as we debate health reform? His vote will be needed by the Democratic leadership.
Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Byron York, The Washington Examiner. Happy Friday, everybody.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Enjoy your weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.